Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. This is your host, Darius Bousefi, and today I'm speaking with Richard Kestenbaum, co-founder and partner at Triangle Capital. Triangle Capital is an investment banking firm. Their website is at trianglecapitalllc.com. Richard recently had an article about the acquisition of Gilt Group by Rulala, and I thought he had made some points that are very important in what's happening in retail. So I wanted to dive in deeper and get some more information about his thoughts. So welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you so much, Darius. It's great to be here.
You made some really good points about the flash sale model business and Rulala and Gilt Group. So maybe dive a little bit deeper into what your thoughts were.
Sure. The thing to remember about Gilt Group is that they created a new business model. The flash sale model didn't exist, and that allowed them to go to brands that had extra stock and say, we'll help you get rid of that stock without creating a conflict with your existing retailers. You won't be undercutting them by dumping your extra product on the market. And consumers loved it because it was an exciting new way to buy product. And it took off, really exploded, and Gilt was the innovator. And they expanded in many different directions. Like so many things, there's a concept called presentism, in which people believe that what's happening in the present moment is the most important thing that has ever happened and will ever happen. And it's a very common human trait to believe that. So when they see a new concept, it's normal for people to believe that this will change everything. This is the most important moment. And so people believed that this was a new and fantastic way to shop, which it is, but that it was bigger and more important than it actually turned out to be. And that created great opportunities for Gilt, great opportunities for them to access product. Every brand wanted to be on Gilt because it was the new and cool way to distribute overstock product. Brands started making product for Gilt. They found a new way to distribute product that they would then make for Gilt that wasn't overstock, and it wouldn't impair their ability to sell through product at full price in their normal retail channels. So they were just making a lot of money doing it. And consumers loved it because they found great opportunities on Gilt. Investors loved it too. The value of Gilt skyrocketed. And they raised a lot of money to expand, and they raised money at very, very high values. Well, Gilt over time is still a great innovation and a great way to shop, but not as great as people expected. So they couldn't continue to raise money at the values that they raised, and they weren't worth as much as they had raised at their peak, or the values at which they had raised at their peak. And that created some disappointment. And it's not that Gilt isn't great. It's just that it's not as great as people expected it to be. And we see that kind of exuberance so often in consumer products, so often in financial markets. And the story of Gilt is the story of that exuberance and that disappointment.
Obviously, it's an interesting idea, and the consumers definitely clicked with it. What is it about the business that was not scalable? Was it the unit economics didn't work, or just the customer acquisition cost was so high, or margins?
I would not say that it's not scalable. What I would say is that if you have a store, sometimes you open up a store and it's a great location and the merchandise is great and it's a great store. That doesn't mean that an individual store on a corner can do $1 billion of sales. But when you open up a store and people start to believe that you can do $1 billion, they get disappointed. And okay. Gilt is a good store, but it's not as big as people had expected it to be. The thing about a physical store is that it's easy to recognize the physical limitations. The thing about online is it's not so easy to recognize the physical limitations. So Gilt was great, but the world is limited. The channels are limited. There's only so many things you can sell a certain way. And no one knew, because it was a completely way of doing things, what the limitations were. So people started pouring more and more stuff through that channel, And it has a limit. There's only so many people who are going to stop what they're doing at whatever time of day the flash sale starts and wait at their computer to buy it. And then stuff starts to get left over. And then people start to push things through the channel that are not true closeout, that are being made to, as I was saying before, that are being made just to be sold on Gilt. And then it loses its authenticity. People lose their excitement. It diminishes in value. And the potential, the perceived potential becomes lower. And that's what happened to Gilt.
Okay.
Doesn't mean it's not a great business.
Right.
That store on that corner that can't do $1 billion, that's still a great store. It's just not a $1 billion store.
Okay. So if we look at, for example, the pie that makes all apparel sales. So this pie includes physical retail, online, and then different types of business models, right? Like, you know, flash sale is one of them. Now we have subscription, rental. What's going to be the future of online apparel sales? Is Amazon going to basically, you know, Amazon's getting into this as well. They are already or are becoming one of the largest apparel retailers in the U.S.
Yes.
Where do you think this pie is going to go?
Well, the apparel market is very big. It's at wholesale, it's a $100 billion business per year. So there's a lot of room for a lot of people in $100 billion a year. And there are many sectors and segments to that market. So Amazon is an amazing company, especially when you know what you want and when what you're shopping for is convenience and not creativity. No one's better at getting stuff to you right away that you can identify. That's very different from buying a dress at Oscar de la Renta. Where there's real merchandising, where there's creativity, where there's inspiration, where there's the element of the deepest part of humanity, that's harder for an Amazon to do. So Amazon is great to buy t-shirts. Amazon is great to buy a plain black mock turtle sweater. But where you want to buy something with design, that's harder for Amazon to do. Doesn't mean they can't figure it out, but there are ways from there. Amazon's very important depending on your product and depending on your brand. The question of what brands belong on Amazon, you know, that's an endless debate. There's certainly a place for Amazon and their business is growing and they're an amazing company. Are they a threat to everyone? No. Are they a threat to a lot of people? Sure. Are they a threat to a Gilt group? In some ways, if you can buy it cheaper, but Gilt has been able to create a niche for themselves by being able to access inventory that other people don't have and present it at a price that is attractive to consumers that isn't available elsewhere. As long as they continue to do that, they'll do well. Let me talk for a minute, and I'm happy to talk about subscription and rentals and other business models. Those are all fascinating topics. Let's talk about the future of Gilt. Gilt was acquired by Hudson's Bay Group, and then it was sold by Hudson's Bay Group to Rue La La. I think the ultimate destination of Gilt, as it has come to rest for now, with Rue La La makes a lot of sense. It makes sense because the two of them are in the same business, and they will be able to consolidate costs by combining. And that consolidation and combination will result in more profit for the combined company. At the same time, they have two brands, and if they present to the world as two brands and keep the front end of the businesses siloed in their two different brand names, they'll be able to continue to build each one of the businesses while consolidating the back-end costs. And that's a good opportunity for them.
A couple of questions on that point. You're in the M&A business. Like, that's a big
yes.
part of your business. So
yes, and thank you for telling our listeners that. I'm in the M&A business. That's right.
Is that good? Okay. That's where people see their life's worth of work get to something. So for founders, this is a very important and valuable service. From your point of view, when you look at two companies that could partner together, one purchasing the other one or merging, what are the main factors that you look at to make this a viable deal? Talking about optimizing the back end functions together. Isn't the front end and the marketing and the customer acquisition actually a lot more expensive these days?
Let me answer that kind of sideways and you'll get the answer. If you're selling a company like they were selling Gilt Group and you look at the range of potential acquirers, generally speaking, the party to whom a company is worth the least is a direct competitor because they have the least to learn and the least to gain from the combination. They already have the skills. They already know the market. So when you see that a company has been bought by its direct competitor, the likely scenario is that they were not able to command a super premium price for their company. And so those two businesses, Rulala and Gilt Group, yes, there's a limit to how much they can consolidate costs. And what that said is the value of Gilt Group to Rulala was the incremental profit that could be realized from cutting the back end costs. Is that the highest and best use of the Gilt Group purchase as wished for by the former Gilt Group owners? No. I don't know this, and I didn't talk to them, and nobody told me, and I have no inside information. But I believe that when the sellers of Gilt Group, which was Hudson's Bay, set out to sell Gilt Group, they did not hope that it would be acquired by Rulala, because that would mean that they would not get the highest value that they would have hoped for. I don't think this was the kind of outcome that resulted in a huge gain for Hudson's Bay. Quite the contrary. I think this was, I wouldn't know if it's the seller of the buyer of last resort, but it was not high on the list of buyers, I would guess.
That's a really good point. Who else would have benefited from adding Gilt Group to it other than Rulala? And why didn't they step up?
You know, just as companies go in fashion, they go out of fashion. And Gilt Group was sold to Rulala at a time when it was out of fashion. People believe that the trends they're seeing are trends that will continue. So as Gilt Group's perception in the market was declining, so was its value and so was its desirability. And potential buyers, I don't know this, but they must have all said, no, we don't see the growth in this, so we don't want to acquire it. But Rulala could see more profit coming to their bottom line from a combination with Gilt than anybody else could by eliminating certain back-end costs. And that's why they wound up being the highest price at the table.
Do you think that Rulala got a good deal?
I don't know. That will depend on how they manage the Gilt brand. If they use the Gilt brand to acquire and sell products that are different than Rulala, then yes, that will give them a new channel into their sourcing and a new channel into their consumer market. If they try and duplicate Rulala or they make a carbon copy of it, then no. So the answer will depend on what Rulala does with Gilt.
I hope that they survive, because I think it's good to have that option for whatever percentage of people that want to have it. Let's talk about other business models, subscription and rental models. What are your thoughts on those?
When the catalog business was created, or when it took off, there were people who created catalog companies, and many of those succeeded. There were people who had other forms of retail like stores, and they created catalogs to create additional revenue for themselves. They're all good businesses. They're all ways of reaching consumers. There are going to be successes and failures. We're seeing that now. We're quite active in subscription businesses. We just signed a letter of intent to sell control of one of our clients. That's a subscription business, and it met with a ready reception. We're in discussions about another subscription company. There's a lot of interest in subscription. Some companies, some products, some organizations are right for subscription. Some subscription businesses can stand on their own as subscription businesses. Some of them belong as an adjunct to other businesses. For example, if you eat breakfast cereal, wouldn't it make sense for you to have your breakfast cereal arrive by subscription? You know you're going to need it. You're probably not going to eat more or less of it at any given time. And why go through the hassle of having to go and buy it or having to run out? Toothpaste, soap, things that you use on replenishment are ideal for subscription. The other kind of subscription that's ideal is surprise. It's like buying yourself a gift every month in a monthly subscription box. So surprise and replenishment are the two ideal things for a subscription, and that's where we're seeing a lot of success. There are risks in subscription. Sometimes the cost of acquiring new customers is high, and sometimes it's high and goes higher. And when that happens, the subscription business becomes a lousy business to be in. So it's like anything, it's like any business, you have to monitor it. And as it scales and it changes and it grows, it has to continue to have the attractive economics. So subscriptions, like any form of retail, going back to our corner store, there are good stores and bad stores. And the stores have to be right for the location and they have to be right for the product. Subscription is the same thing. That's true of rental also. Rental is a great product for, in some ways, the opposite kind of product as a subscription replenishment product. Subscription replenishment is ideal for the kinds of products where you know you're going to use them, you know how much, and they just need to keep on arriving in your home in a regular flow. A rental product is a great form for where you know you're only going to need the product for a short time. Right? Think about what Netflix used to be. It used to be DVDs that would arrive in your home for a certain amount of time. You'd watch the movie or whatever it was, and you'd return it to them. That's ideal. You may have an occasion garment, a dress, that you know you have a family wedding or some event, and you know you want a garment for that time and you don't want it for other times. That's also an ideal circumstance. The other kind of circumstance is if a garment has a high fashion content, you may not want to wear that all the time. It may not be appropriate or in fashion for a long time. So you may want to own that for a short time. You're probably never going to rent a navy blue suit or a little black cocktail dress, because you know that years and years down the road, as long as it still fits, you can still wear. So for basics, rental's not the kind of business or the kind of channel that's appropriate. But for things that you know you're only going to need for a short time, rental is ideal.
What about direct to consumer?
Direct to consumer is where the world is going. It used to be true that you could ask three questions. Does it fit? Does it look great? Is it priced right? If the answer to that was yes, you got yourself a sale. Those three questions are still critically important, but they're only the beginning now. Now consumers want to know a lot more things. They want to know about values. I don't mean economic values, although that's part of it. They want to know, is the product artisanal? Is it made locally? Is it ethical? Was everyone in the supply chain paid a fair wage? Was there child labor? What country was it made in? Is the environment better or is the environment worse because of the production of this product? Ultimately, they want to know, am I helping the world or am I hurting the world? If I'm helping the world, I'm a better person for buying this product. If I'm hurting the world, well, I don't want to go there. The way in which those values are now communicated to consumers is via social media, and consumers want that kind of information. It has been very hard for legacy brands to graft onto their structure social media communication that resonates with consumers and sounds authentic. And that's why there has been this lowering of barriers because of the weaknesses of historical legacy brands that allow new direct-to-consumer brands to chip away at the market share that historical brands have had. And that's a big opportunity. So yes, direct to consumer is here. Direct to consumer is going to be a permanent fixture in our market, and it's going to build and grow.
So let's talk a little bit about the big player. Right now, there is a battle going on. In the US mostly, it seems to be between Amazon and Walmart. Is that correct in your view?
Well, these are multi-hundred billion dollar companies that are selling products at retail. There isn't that much room in the market for both of them to, let's say, double in size, right? It's not possible, or probably not possible. As Amazon gets to be $200 billion and Walmart is $500 billion, how can these two continue to grow? They both want growth. They both have had a different path towards success. So they have very different ways of doing what they're doing, and they both have their challenges. Can they both continue to succeed? Yes. Can they both grow at very high rates? No, there isn't enough room in the market for that to happen. So yes, Walmart needs to be stronger in online. Amazon needs to attract more of the customers that currently go to Walmart.
Walmart has become more active and modern, I would say, in how they grow their business. The Mark Lurie joining them, purchasing Bonobos, and now, of course, Flipkart in India. Do you think it's possible for Walmart to battle Amazon just being a retailer?
Well, Amazon is a retailer and Walmart's a retailer, and they're doing battle in the retail world, and they approach it in different ways and to a large degree, a lot of different consumers. It's true that Amazon has AWS to support its retail business, and that's been an enormous help. Amazon has had essentially free capital by the market constantly improving its sales price, even though its financial performance has not been held to account to the same level that most retailers are held. But Amazon also has a lot of risk. In order for Amazon to continue to have access to capital, it needs a continued subsidy from AWS, and it needs its stock price to continue to rise. In most companies, shareholders would be screaming for the spin-out of AWS. And in order for Amazon to continue to have a rising stock price, they need to grow by what most people tell me or think is 20 to 25% per year. As Amazon grows, that's going to be increasingly harder to do. And Amazon has a big risk in its people. A lot of its people are incentivized using Amazon stock. So if Amazon reaches the point where it can't grow by 20 to 25% per year, then its stock won't continue to increase. When that happens, a lot of the incentive that their middle and upper management has to continue to stay and work at Amazon will go away, and those people will leave. They're very desirable people on the job market. They have experience at Amazon, and lots of companies would like to hire Amazon people. So there's a lot of risk for Amazon in continuing to grow. And you ask yourself, okay, they're about $200 billion. Can they get to $400 billion? Can they get to $800 billion? If they can't, I don't think they can just mature and become a 2% top-line growth company and continue to remain as great as they are. There's a lot of risk. They're going to lose access to capital that they need to experiment and grow, and they're going to lose access to a lot of their people. So they're each dealing with a lot of strengths and risks that they have. Walmart, of course, is very big, and it faces enormous obstacles in being able to grow online. And they're at a relatively lower, a much lower share of the online market than Amazon has today, but they are big. They have a lot of resources, and I have to admire the moxie they have in experimenting, because no one knows today what the future model of retail and retail stores are. And the thing about Walmart that they're doing now is they're saying, look, we're strong. We have a strong balance sheet and we're big. We can experiment with a lot of things and know that a lot of them won't work, but we're going to find the right model. You know, that's great. So many big companies are afraid of their own shadows and can't take the risk culturally that Walmart is taking.
Completely agree with you. I mean, I've done some work at both of these companies, and I know that innovation and the pace of innovation is going to make the difference. And of course, Amazon was built on that. But well, for Walmart, this is something that they had to learn. They still have a long way to go, but I see a lot of positive signs. So it'll be interesting. I want to close on learning more about you and Triangle Capital. You've been in this business for 35 years. So you've probably seen a couple of things change in that process, right?
You know, Darius, this is the most interesting time at work that I've ever seen. I never imagined that it would be as exciting and interesting to come to work at this stage of my life. But it's fantastic every day. You meet the most interesting and amazing young entrepreneurs that never existed before, or, you know, in a much smaller scale and with a very different approach. And the changes that we're seeing and the ways in which products are sold, it's fascinating every day.
Definitely. From my point of view, also business, as well as the podcast, it is a pretty exciting time. What are the type of companies that you actually work with?
We represent consumer-facing companies that have values between $10 and $200 million. We help them get sold, and we help them raise capital. That's 90-plus percent of our business. We do mergers, acquisitions, and capital raising for consumer-facing companies, and our transactions are $10 to $200 million. Most of the time. We usually work with companies that have history and where the valuation can be, whether they're profitable or not, the valuation can be worked out on a spreadsheet. And our goal is to take that spreadsheet and get people to pay a much higher value than you could justify by the math of it. We're really proud of our track record. We've gotten lots of people to pay very high values for our clients and the companies we've sold and represented. But we don't do startups. Startups are a different market of investors, and that's usually not a market of investors that we talk to on a regular basis.
It was awesome speaking with you, Richard.
Great talking with you, Dennis. Thank you.
Learned a lot, and hopefully we'll talk again some other time.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.